The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week, there was a question about delusion. So I thought I would talk about delusion today, what it is, how it works, how we can learn to recognize delusion. So delusion is one of the three what are called roots of unwholesome experience. And these three are greed, aversion, and greed, the wanting to have things, wanting things to continue, wanting anything from physical things, sense pleasure, to mental states. That greed includes all aspects of wanting. Aversion, wanting to get rid of things, not wanting to have things. And delusion, which is often something that people aren't really sure about what it means. And there's not as simple a definition of delusion as there is of greed and aversion. So pretty much this talk is going to explore the various aspects of delusion. So greed and aversion are often more obvious to us. And part of the question that was asked last week had to do with the reflection or the thinking or the seeing that delusion comes out of greed and aversion. And there is delusion that comes out of greed and aversion. That because we don't like something, for instance, if we're averse to something, we might kind of block it out of our experience, and we might just not connect with aspects of our experience that we don't like, kind of an ignoring or pushing away of experience, and not connecting with experience because we don't like it. And this can happen kind of subconsciously in a way that, you know, we have this filter of, well, I don't like dealing with certain kinds of people, and so we just, you know, ignore them. We just have that filter, and we just don't connect with those kinds of people. It could even get to the place of almost not seeing them. So there is a kind of delusion that can come out of greed and aversion. But delusion is more fundamental than greed and aversion is. Greed and aversion spring from delusion. When greed and aversion are present, there is delusion already present. And I'll talk more about how that part works at the end. So delusion can arise in the absence of greed and aversion, which makes it more fundamental. But greed and aversion will always have delusion as part of them. So this is in the way that delusion is more basic. So there's three basic aspects of delusion that I'm going to talk about today. And they are the delusion of not connecting, kind of the absence of awareness, the delusion of denial, and the delusion of misperception or distorted perception or perverted perception. The term in Pali is often translated as perversion of perception, that it's twisted, that our perception of things is actually twisted such that we see things in a way that is not accurate. And this is a kind of a fundamental delusion that we operate with all the time. So the first kind of delusion, or this not connecting, this unawareness, this is the pretty basic kind, and we actually do live in this, especially before we begin meditation practice, we live in this a lot, in a constructed world where we're lost in thought and not connecting with what's actually happening. We're living in a world of delusion. Living in an unreal world. I found in my own experience, you know, this can be kind of startling. You know, as I was starting to explore my experience with mindfulness, I began to notice the kind of coming out of that thought world. You know, kind of like it's like this bubble that's been created, and the mind is off in this world of being in some other place and some other time. And then coming back into awareness, into this moment, it's like that bubble just gets burst. This was particularly striking for me at one particular time when I had worked through some difficulties around a particular relationship ending. And I was no longer reactive to the thoughts about that person arising in my mind. So that I no longer, as soon as that, it used to be before I kind of had worked through these issues of anger and hostility and ill will towards that person, whenever that person would arise in my mind, those feelings of anger, hostility would naturally arise with it, with those thoughts. And so, you know, I would quickly get lost in the anger. And that would be my predominant experience, is being lost in that anger. But as the anger fell away and I was no longer manipulated emotionally by the thoughts, what I started seeing was the more pure, deluded nature of thinking. Because I noticed that I would wake up in the midst of a thought where I was back in the relationship, we were doing things, we were planning things, and then, you know, because there was no reactivity anymore, it wasn't triggering off the emotional response of anger or frustration or sadness or whatever else might come along with those thoughts. And in the coming back into awareness, it was like the mind was completely confused in that moment of where that bubble burst, because the mind felt in that space of the thought that I was back in that relationship. So it had constructed this reality, this deluded reality that it believed in while I was lost in the thought. And then in coming back, the bubble bursting, it's like the mind was just confused. It's like, well, wait a minute, what's going on? You know, 2 seconds ago I was in this relationship. I know I'm not in this relationship, you know. And it was partly that I could see this kind of delusion was partly because there was no longer any reactivity around the thoughts. I could really just see how the mind created a world and lived in it. This is delusion. And we do this a lot. A lot of what we create in our minds has to do with the way we're living in the world. You know, it's not often quite so obvious, like this example where the mind had created a world of, you know, some years before and was living in that world where it's clearly this is not the reality. But often we do live in a world that we're constructing in our minds, not actually connected with the actual experience of what is actually happening here and now. So that's one way that this not connecting, this non-awareness manifests as delusion, as these thought worlds, these thought bubbles that we create. Then there are some aspects of the five hindrances that are particularly delusion-connected. They're not always only delusion, but they have a large component of delusion to them. So dullness, sleepiness, torpor, those qualities of just like feeling like there's a fuzz over the mind or a haze or not being able to connect through the fog to what's happening, there can be a component of delusion to that. It's not necessarily greed or aversion. There can be a manifestation. Those can arise out of greed or aversion, often aversion, not wanting to see something. If there's something that's coming up that we don't want to deal with, sometimes the mind can kind of shut down and go into that haze or that delusion space. It's like, I'd rather be hazy. I'd rather feel delusion than feel this anger. So they can be motivated out of the greed and aversion. Here's another example of how the delusion can arise out of greed and aversion. But it's that hazy feeling, that sleepiness, dullness, can be a manifestation of delusion. Likewise with restlessness, the quality of mind that's agitated, of not able to land on anything. Again, it might be aversion, it might be greed of wanting to get all of these different things. And it can simply be the mind in a state of just unsettledness, not necessarily connected with greed or aversion. And is there a question? Did you have something, Sonia? Did you? No? Okay.
As you were talking, I was thinking that
something came up. Okay. All right. Because if you do have questions, please raise your hand and we'll use the mic. I mean, this is, I have quite a bit I can say, but I want to keep it open for discussion. It doesn't have to be just a linear talk where I go through the whole thing and then answer questions. So raise your hand if you've got a question. Okay.
Yeah, I'm Sonia. And you were talking about the restlessness of the mind. And but I was more, I don't know if it's thinking, but for me it was more the restlessness of my body, but I think they're connected. I mean, I never know what triggers what. So.
Yes, there's an intimate connection between the two, between body and mind. Sometimes the restless body can arise unconnected with the restless mind, but there often is a connection between the two, yeah. And that restless body might, you know, it might not be delusion. It might just simply be a physical kind of manifestation. The other hindrance that has some aspects of delusion to it is doubt. This kind of doubt is actually defined as a kind of a wavering of mind. It's like not being sure, uncertainty of what to do. And the doubt that's a hindrance is around doubt around the practice, the teachings, the teachers, your own ability to engage in the practice. And it can manifest, the description of this is that it kind of manifests as somebody who's lost in a wilderness, that not knowing which way to go, you take a few steps in one direction, then think, oh, that's not the right way, and go back. Take a few steps in another direction, oh, that's not the right way, and go back. So there's this confusion that's operating in the mind. And again, it might not necessarily be out of greed or aversion. There can be greed or aversion that's fueling it, but it can also simply be a not knowing. It can be a not having enough information that might not necessarily be greed or aversion connected. So those are some of the ways in which delusion manifests as this not connecting, this lack of awareness. Is that any questions about that part or anything? Yeah. Okay.
My name is Larry. So is doubt connected to delusion as one of the hindrances?
Yes. That's what I was saying. Yeah.
That's all I asked.
Okay, yeah. Again, the doubt as a hindrance may arise out of aversion or out of greed, you know, kind of like that doubt might arise. If there's greed, for example, there might be a sense of, you know, having heard all of these great teachings in California, you know, we're exposed to so many different teachings. It's like, oh, which one do I do? You know, I want to try them all. And then we try a little bit of this one. Oh, well, let me try this one. And so we waver. You know, we don't really connect with any of them because of that greed moving out. So it can have it can be rooted out of greed or aversion. It might be, you know, why do I want to pay attention to these teachings? The Buddha taught 2,500 years ago. What kind of possible relevance could this have to me? And so, you know, we kind of maybe try a little bit, and then we think about, well, you know, but this doesn't apply to everyday life here. I mean, after all, we have computers, and the Buddha never heard about computers. So, and then we're off again. So, you know, that doubt can manifest out of greed and or aversion, but it might simply be a doubt manifesting out of not knowing, not having enough information. So that it can come out of that just pure delusion as well. But the quality of doubt of, you know, that a little bit here, come back a little bit there, has a deluded nature to it. Doubt, why is it deluded necessarily?
Yeah, going a little bit here. I could see how it is sometimes, but maybe not necessarily.
Well, the quality of doubt of uncertainty. I mean, if you're doing like the question was, because it didn't get recorded, why is it necessarily doubt to have that kind of movement of wavering? And that's the kind of description of how it manifests mentally, that it's like you're taking a few steps in one direction and then a few steps in another direction. The doubt part is fundamentally an uncertainty about what to do. And that uncertainty itself is there's a kind of delusion around it that it may simply be the delusion of not knowing. It may be the delusion of I'll actually get to some of the other kinds of delusions a little bit more later. Trying to see if I can figure out a way to describe why that is doubt or why that is delusion. Because it's a not knowing, because it's a not... and some of that not knowing might be, as I say, just a lack of information. But delusion can spring out of a lack of information. Perhaps it will be a little clearer as I go on and talk about some of the other kinds. So denial is the second kind of delusion. And again, there's a form of denial, and I think the way we often think about denial in our daily life, especially the psychological way we think about denial, we talk about, oh, that person's in denial. You know, they're not seeing something. They're in denial. You know, they're feeling a particular emotion, but they're not acknowledging it. They're in denial. That's kind of the typical way we use the term denial. So it's the way we typically use it in that sense, again, often has a component of greed or aversion underneath it. That, for instance, maybe a form of not wanting to see the truth, the kind of classic elephant in the room of a family with a dysfunctional person in the family, you know, an alcoholic father, and nobody talks about it, nobody speaks about it. There's denial around that, and a form of delusion is present in the not connecting with that, and even the not seeing. I mean, there can be, it's like, you know, you have been taught from the time you're very young that oh no, Dad is just, you know, whatever. Dad's had a rough day, whatever. Yeah, Dad is that. You know, it's you know, and so you don't see, or you stop being able to connect with the aspects of experience. So there can be that kind of denial that results in a not seeing, actually. And that's delusion. That, again, that not seeing, that not connecting with. That's coming, again, that's coming out of, that one particularly is coming out of aversion in a way. It's like, this is too messy. We don't want to deal with this. So let's ignore it. Let's cut it aside. So that's a form of denial. That also can come out of greed as well. You know, the idea when you're first falling in love, this will last forever. You know, that feeling of, oh, of course, this is going to be perfect for the rest of my life. That's delusion. No. And that's more connected with greed. You know, that wish for it to continue, that wanting it to continue. It's, you know, that we, and the feeling of it is so great that we want it to continue, and we delude ourselves into believing that it will continue. And lo and behold, when it doesn't, we feel betrayed, we feel frustrated, we're lost, we feel like, you know, why did this have to happen to me? So those are forms of denial that are rooted in greed and aversion. And then there can be some pure forms, and as I said, those kinds of denial are typically what we mean when we talk about denial in everyday parlance. But there's some other forms of denial that aren't necessarily connected to greed and aversion. And these have to do with, the best way I came up with thinking about it or talking about it is as views that are formed because we're either told something repeatedly, so we believe it's true, and then we then interpret our experience from that perspective. We see things through that filter and see things that confirm that view and don't see things that don't confirm that view. Or because we're told something by somebody who we have a lot of trust in, and perhaps we misunderstand what they mean, and so we create a kind of a perverted view around with this faith or trust in an authority. So, an example about this, a couple of examples, one from my own experience, and I've been thinking about this question because somebody came up to me and said, well, how can denial be purely without greed or aversion? It seems like denial has always got aversion under it. This person was thinking in that terms, that it was related to aversion. And I didn't have an answer for him right away. And so it was kind of this koan in my mind around, how can denial be without greed or aversion? And I was cutting an apple the other morning, and I was flashed back to a time when I was taking an art class when I was a child. And the art teacher that I had was very skillful around helping us see form and color. And, you know, we were drawing apples in this art class, hence the connection for the memory. You know, she was very skillful in pointing us to seeing how the color changed in our actual experience, you know, that it changed from darker around the edges and then got to this place where it's just white where the light is reflecting off the apple. So she was very skilled at helping us see color. And some of us were drawing the apples and some of us were drawing them kind of lopsided. And she came up to us and she said, apples aren't lopsided. They don't grow lopsided. And, you know, the rest of us are thinking, huh? You know, we've all seen lopsided apples. And at one point, you know, she kept saying this to us. I mean, she refused. We all had to change our drawings so that we'd have these perfectly, you know, symmetrical-looking apples. And one day, one little boy brought in this apple that, you know, clearly was lopsided. And put it on her desk, you know, without comment, you know, just put it on her desk. And she didn't say a word, you know. It's like, I don't know what would have happened if he'd pointed it out to her. See, this is a lopsided apple. He didn't do that. But she just didn't comment. I mean, so I don't know if she was really in denial about the shape of apples. But I can imagine, I mean, as I thought about this, and as actually I cut this apple, I have a tendency to cut my apple along a line of symmetry so that it falls apart in mirror images. And I think that actually the growth of things, the growth of apples, has a kind of symmetrical quality to it. You know, that's the natural form of growth, that it creates a symmetry. So there's one way to cut an apple. Even though this apple that I was cutting the other day was really lopsided, you know, it had a big bulge on one side. But I could cut it, and it fell apart into kind of two symmetrical pieces. And I thought, you know, maybe that teacher was told by some authority in a biology class, apples grow symmetrically. And she misunderstood the term symmetrical to mean perfectly shaped, all around symmetrical. And having heard that and misunderstood the meaning created a view that all apples are symmetrical. That would be delusion, without necessarily having greed or aversion. And not being able to see information that runs counter. I mean, how could she not have noticed that apples were lopsided in all of her life? I mean, there's so much evidence to the contrary for that view. And yet, this is the way, I mean, this is an extreme example, but we create views all the time based on what we hear from what people tell us. We create views all the time around that. And we believe them. And we see our world in terms of that view, picking out the information that confirms it and ignoring the information that doesn't confirm it. That's delusion. It's not seeing what's there. Another example that can be even more tenacious than views formed out of things that people are telling us are views that are formed out of our own perceptual experience. So we come in contact with the world repeatedly, and based on what we come in contact with, we form views about how the world is. Our contact with the world may be limited to certain areas, certain aspects, which in turn limits our views. So the classic example on this kind of delusional view is the story of the blind men and the elephants, where the story is, and this story is actually in the suttas. It's in the Buddha tells this story. So it's an ancient Indian teaching story. That there was a kingdom where the king asked all the blind people in the kingdom to be brought together and to show the blind people an elephant. And to some people, some of the blind people, they showed them or had them touch different aspects of the elephant's body. So some touched the legs, some touched the trunk, some touched the ears, some touched the tail, some touched the side of the elephant. And then coming back, the king said, okay, tell me what an elephant is like. And the people who touched the legs said, well, an elephant is like a post. The people who touched the side of the elephant said, the elephant is like a storeroom, a wall. The people who touched the ears said, it's like a winnowing basket. The people who touched the tail said, it's like a broom. people who'd touched the trunk, well, a hose of some sort. I can't remember what the Indian thing was that it was like. But so the blind people, having come in contact with the elephant, formed views about what the elephant was. And then hearing all the disparate views, the story goes that they argued among themselves. An elephant's like this, it's not like that. No, you're wrong. An elephant's like this, it's not like that. Coming to blows over their beliefs formed out of their direct perception. So this is our caution to us, the caution to us, that even views formed out of our direct experience may be views formed out of incomplete information. And the delusion is that we believe these views to be only this is true, everything else is wrong. A kind of classic thing that actually in our own history created great difficulty was the belief that the earth was the center of the universe. And people were killed for stating different beliefs than that. Now, looking at our direct experience, sure looks like the earth is standing still and everything else is moving around us. So, to propose that, well, in fact, maybe the earth is hurtling through space. This was, at a particular period of our history, heresy to say this. This is, again, views created out of experience, out of direct experience, and misperceiving, not having, or saying, let's say, not necessarily misperceiving, because there is, those blind men that touched the legs of the elephant actually touched them and understood that part of the elephant, but didn't know there was a bigger picture. So there are views that we then see the world through these views, denying that the world is otherwise. That's the denial. That's the aspect of denial. The third kind of delusion is related to these way I described these views forming, but they are so. It's basically some perversions of this perversion of perception, perversions of reality, a fundamental misunderstanding of reality. Again, often based on our own perception of what we perceive, and these particular ones are so fundamental misperceptions of reality and so hard to see that the Buddha kind of called them out and said, let's pay particular attention to these. So there are four basic distortions at this fundamental level that we make. There's a distortion of seeing what is impermanent as permanent. There's the distortion of seeing what is unsatisfactory in terms of being a lasting source of happiness, as being satisfactory, as being a place where happiness can be found, lasting happiness can be found. there is a seeing of self, of me, of mine, of I, where there is no self. And there is a seeing of things as beautiful that are unbeautiful. So a little bit about each of these and my kind of exploration of this kind of distortion. Before I go into that, I'll just put out one other piece around delusion in general, except for this completely unconnected experience. Around this these distortions of reality, the delusion aspect of mind doesn't obscure the experience. It doesn't obscure, so it's not that we're not connecting with experience. It's just that we're connecting in a fundamentally erroneous way. So as my teacher puts it, the delusion doesn't mask our experience, it masks the true nature of the experience. So we have this experience of seeing something, and we don't see its impermanent nature. We impute a permanence to it. So the seeing permanent in the impermanent, this there was an example that I saw of this at the Exploratorium. Some of you might have heard me give this example before, that really highlighted for me how our perceptual process itself is designed to create this illusion of things being out there and because we have that perception of things being out there as a perception in our minds, we then take that perception to be what is out there. So, the example from the Exploratorium. I came to the Exploratorium with my nephew. This was a few years ago. He was about 10 years old. And we walked into the Exploratorium, and for those of you who haven't been there, it's a large warehouse-like room. And you know, kind of see across the room as you walk into the Exploratorium. And towards the back of the warehouse, there were maybe 10 or so large rods hanging from the ceiling. They were spaced maybe 4 feet apart. And they were maybe 4 feet long. So they were these 4 foot long rods spaced 4 feet apart. And on these rods were flashing lights. And I looked up in that and saw these kind of interesting patterns of flashing lights. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what that's about. And figured I'd, you know, check it out when we got closer up there. And at one point, my nephew and I stopped to have a drink. And we were just sitting down kind of having our drink. And my nephew, looking up at those bars, the flashing lights on the bar, said, "It's a school bus." And I looked up and I saw a bunch of yellow flashing lights and a little bit of red. And I said to him, "Well, I see that it's the color that a school bus might be, but I don't see a school bus." And then he said, "It's butterflies." And I was like, "What are you talking about? I don't see butterflies." But I was curious. I was very curious. So I spent some time. And it's kind of one of those optical things where you need to kind of look at it just at the right, in just the right way. And I think it's like just scanning your eyes at the right motion across the bars, you know, at the right speed. Because at some point in my doing that, when my eyes just hit the right motion, what appeared in my visual field was a screen 40 feet wide, 4 feet high, upon which I could see a school bus driving across. It was moving. It was a school bus that was moving across. The image was so detailed that I could read the name of the school district on the side of the school bus. It was that clear. It was mind-blowing how clear it was and how the mind constructed out of little particles of light. There's a kind of, I think it's a phenomenon called the persistence of vision, that when the eye sees something, it holds on to that. Or it may be more brain, I don't know where it's happening. But it holds on to and remembers what it's seen a moment before. So that even if it's not present there, it remembers it. And the idea is that, you know, on one bar, it's kind of like you're looking through a fence that's got these slits in it and see something driving past. So there's, you know, you've got this one little bit that's showing you what is appearing in that slit. And then, you know, as it moves behind the screen, you know, it disappears, but then it picks up again at the next slit and then moves again and picks up again at the next slit. And what the mind does with that is it remembers all of those flashes that are necessary to bridge the gap between the two slits and creates the image between them. This is our mind creating permanence. So we do this in our daily lives as well. We, at gross and subtle levels, we do not take in the fact of impermanence. The grossest misperception around this is our own mortality. There's this kind of story. I don't know really how true this story is, but Jack Kornfield tells it, and he claims it happened in a group that he was leading one time, where somebody asked a question about death, and Jack put the question out to the group and said, "Well, how many of you are going to die?" And about half the group raised their hands. So we do not recognize ourselves. And there's a kind of a sense that we know, we see beings around us dying all the time, and yet we don't ourselves take in this fact for ourselves. One of the grossest misperceptions around impermanence. Then, you know, down to the more subtle level of, you know, painful experience in our body. You know, we experience pain often as a block, as a thing, as a kind of, you know, we're experiencing a pain in our knee. It's like this big, massive block of pain. And yet when we start to bring our mindful attention to it, if we cannot be reactive, not be resistant to the experience of pain itself, what we start to see is that it's not a block. It's actually a mass of rapidly changing phenomenon, very rapidly changing phenomenon, that if you try in your mindfulness to pinpoint where the strongest bit of pain is, you'll find, maybe you find it for a split second, and then it jumps, it moves to another place. So the imputation of it as a thing, as something solid, is incorrect. It's a dynamic, changing flow of experience. And this is also how we see our lives kind of as a thing. And our lives are dynamic, changing flow of experience. So there's just this fundamental misperception. Everything in our experience, everything that we come into contact with in our experience is impermanent. It's changing. It's changing so rapidly that in a way the rapidity of change itself is masking the change. It's kind of like seeing a movie, one of those old kind of movies now that actually had the different frames, that they're still frames. And yet when they move rapidly, there's the illusion of movement and continuity. Likewise with our experience, change is happening so quickly that it creates this illusion of solidity, of stability. And that's why we misperceive what is impermanent as permanent. Seeing happiness in what is suffering. This one is, it has to do with the way in which we've learned that we get happiness. You know, we feel good when we get something that we want. We learned that from the time we're very young. We have a sense of wanting something, a sense of lack, a sense of that if we had something that we would be happier. And we get that thing, and we find ourselves happier. Now there's two reasons why we feel happier when we get that thing. One is because we've gotten something that we want. Potentially it makes us feel good when we get it. A piece of chocolate, for instance. You know, chocolate itself has a kind of a happiness-producing quality. It creates endorphins in the brain or something. The other aspect of that happiness has to do with the fact that the wanting has disappeared. And this is actually the larger reason why we're happy when we get what we want. And this is the fundamental misunderstanding that we have about where happiness comes from. Because over and over again in our experience, we see that when we get what we want, we have this moment of happiness. And so we think that's the way to be happy, to just continually get what we want, to try to arrange our lives in a way such that, if we can, line up moments of getting what we want, that is happiness. But what that actually does for us is it conditions this wanting and this continual like feeling of, oh, gotta get the next thing, gotta get the next thing, gotta get the next thing, this restless movement of mind to continually try to satisfy our needs, to try to satisfy our desires.
I'm having a hard time. So being in a state of bliss is delusional?
If you are aware of it as a state of bliss,
right,
it's not delusion.
Just a pure sense of being.
Again, if you're aware of it. So what's the confusion? Is it that...
Well, you're not creating impermanence, or in the state of human good is part of greed, or...
Indeed, it is. And this is where the teachings get a little more subtle, in fact. You know, that initially what is most helpful to us is to let go of the obvious ways that we want things. You know, to let go of wanting material things, to let go of wanting sense desires, satisfy sense desires. Then the next step is that we learn that that we can abandon those sense desires more easily through coming into meditation, coming into a space of constructing wholesome mind states, concentration, which leads to happiness, leads to bliss. So it's easier to let go of, in a way, the sense pleasures because there are, in fact, greater pleasures. They're not sense pleasures. They're kind of they're mental pleasures of the joy, of the bliss, of concentration. And that makes it easier for us to let go of the grosser kinds of wanting. But then what often happens is that we end up wanting these states, which are also constructed states. And then the next part of the practice is learning about that kind of clinging to those states as well. That any clinging to anything, even if it's a wholesome state, causes an agitation, causes a sense of dissatisfaction. When we don't have that state, we want it. We have that feeling of dissatisfaction, of something's not right. If I'm not in a state of bliss, something's not right. That's suffering. If we're in a state of bliss and we want it to continue, that feeling of holding on to it, that's also an agitation in the mind of needing things to be a certain way. So the next step in the path is to learn to let go of even the wanting, the clinging to wholesome mind states. Now, it doesn't mean that the wholesome mind states disappear. It means that we stop wanting them, that we stop needing to have them in order to feel happiness. And this moves us towards equanimity, the balance of mind that is simply at ease with whatever's happening, whether it's blissful mind state or not. So it's a kind of a journey through the more and more subtle levels of this wanting. Does that make sense? Is that... Okay. So the seeing happiness in the wanting itself, that we think that it's through the wanting that we can get the happiness. That's the fundamental misunderstanding around seeing what is suffering as happiness. That we learn as we engage in this practice that there's actually a deeper happiness around the letting go. If you observe in your own experience the wanting and watch the wanting until it disappears, as it will, because it is impermanent, as all things are, you will discover a kind of happiness that results from letting go of something as opposed to trying to hold on to something. Just simply noticing that wanting, that wanting, that wanting. It's just like watching it arise and pass away. As it disappears, there's a kind of a feeling of being let out of a vice grip from that wanting. And when that wanting disappears, the suffering disappears. So that's that distortion. I'm not going to get through the rest of these, I can tell. So maybe I will just not go into the others in detail. I think I'll just end with a little bit of a discussion about how more fundamentally greed and aversion arise out of this delusion, these four delusions. That basically, the reason why we want things is because we think there are things out there to have. So we think there are things permanent out there that we can have. We think that they will create happiness for us. And we think that there is someone here to have them. If we didn't have those fundamental distortions of perception, greed would not arise. Likewise with aversion. The fundamental distortions of perception, there's something out there that is making me feel uncomfortable. If I could only get rid of that thing, then I would be happy. the sense of my happiness depending on conditions created in the world in a certain way. If we didn't have these fundamental delusions, aversion would not arise. So in that way, the delusion is the root of, and it's these misperceptions that are the root of all of the suffering that we find ourselves in. So, any other questions? We've got about 3 minutes with any, if there's any other questions or thoughts. Mm-hmm. Here. You might, I don't know if you can do that with your voice on.
I might. Okay. I won't. The last one was very challenging. The one where you said, we have this delusion that there's somebody there.
That's the one I didn't quite get to.
I'm going to be gone for 3 weeks, so I'm going to miss it. But I would love to have you deal with that, because that is where I am.
Yeah.
And that's fundamental.
It's incredible. Yes, it's very fundamental. And it's very challenging. I mean, we can hear about this teaching that there's no one there. And, you know, as a view that we're seeing our life through, you know, this is a classic example of not being able to see evidence to the contrary. There's actually evidence out there that there's no one here, but we can't see it. So it's so fundamental, so deeply ingrained that we are here, that everything that we see confirms that we are here. So, that's a hard one to get underneath. And the path towards getting underneath it has to do with the moment-to-moment touching into experience. So I can talk about that. Would you like me to talk about that next week? I know you're not going to be here, but we'll record it. But, would you like to hear about that? I mean, because it's a mind twister. Sometimes people don't want to hear about it, this not self teaching.
It seems fundamental as the first step, but it's really kind of the last step.
It is, in fact, it is the last step. I mean, you know, there is a teaching on the various things that we let go of through the path of awakening. And they're said to be 4 stages of awakening, 4 distinct realizations of deep enlightenment. And the first stage of enlightenment, somebody who's really deeply seen into the nature of reality, has cut through what is called personality view, which is a belief in an identity. And yet the belief, the fundamental feeling, I am, is said to not go until the very last stage of awakening. So it's going to be with us for a long time. You get intimations of it through the practice, such that you can really, you know, you can sign up for this understanding. Go, yeah, I understand. I believe that it's true. You can get intimations of it such that you'll understand its truth. But, you know, until you've gotten those intimations, it's, like, really hard to, like, I don't know about that one. They're just wrong about that one. I know they're wrong about that one. So, I can talk about that. I like having the theme come out of the discussion, so I'll talk about that next weekend. Sorry, you're not going to be
Thank
here to
you.
Hear it.
How do I get the tapes?
Oh, they're on online. Do you have access?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah, they're recorded.
Oh, so I can hear this again.
Yes. So, thank you for your attention and your engagement.